Continuing in Mitzvah Shin Chav Dalet 324, the mitzvah to take the lulav and the related species on Sukkis. And there is a din on the first day of Sukkis, because that's the day that's deraisa. And of course, if you find yourself in a situation where all 7 days are deraisa, such as in the Beis HaMikdash, then these dinim will apply on all 7 days. But the din is, on the first day it says, ulkachtem lachem, that the lulav must belong to you. A borrowed lulav is not acceptable, which is not the case on the other days of Sukkis outside the Beis HaMikdash. So on the other days of Sukkis, if you want to borrow someone's lulav, say, hey, can I shake your lulav? I forgot mine at home. Sure, he hands it to you. You shake it, you hand it back, no problem. You don't need any fancy methods of acquisition. And on the first day of Sukkis, you actually must own the lulav in order to be yotzei the mitzvah. So that's why on the first day of Sukkis, if you don't have your own lulav, then you must actually acquire someone else's lulav in order to use it. So the method of doing that normally is that because the first person, the original owner of the lulav, wants to make sure he or she gets his lulav back. So you do what's called the matana al menas lahachzir, which is a halachic mechanism that's not like lending, but it's like someone owns something temporarily. So the way to do that is you hand someone the lulav and you say, here, either I'm giving this to you as a present on the condition that you return it to me. And if you don't return it to me afterwards, then it's not going to be a present from now. So in other words, it's a question as to actually whether you need to state the entire condition there. You can just say this is a present on condition of returning. But that is considered to be a sufficient present in halacha. And you're considered to fully own it for the time period because it's like a condition. It's just like anything, that there's something that can be absolute but on condition. It's like in theory, it's possible for a husband to give his wife a get and say, here, this, if you do 25 jumping jacks, this is going to be a get. This is a get. And if you don't do 25 jumping jacks, then this is not going to be a get. So it's possible to do it. And, you know, that's an absolute, once she does 25 jumping jacks, so that divorce takes effect. So the same thing over here, that it's considered a full temporary ownership on condition that the fella returns it. So, yeah.
So that means when women walk around as Rishnashim, offering lulav and esrog, it's no good. Because there's no, they just give it to them. There's no.
On the other days or the first day?
The first day.
So no, you have to acquire it. No, a woman, if she...
Anything.
Right, a woman, if she wishes to fulfill the mitzvah of lulav, which is not obligated to, but if she wishes to fulfill it on the first day, then there's... If you just borrow the lulav, then there's no point. It's right. Not fulfilled, she didn't fulfill
suppose
the mitzvah at all.
Suppose he goes to Ashkam and Binyan and you go to the regular...
Oh, the wife has to own it separately. You personally
have to
own
it separately.
Yeah. Okay. But the trick to that thing is that if you don't give the lulav back, then you didn't fulfill the mitzvah either.
Because you stole.
Because you didn't fulfill the condition mm-hmm. of the present. Yeah. So it was never a present to you. So, in fact, if you try to steal it, or keep it for yourself, that doesn't even work, because it's still the first guys to begin with.
Now, this doesn't work for Machiros Chomets, right? We, you know, even though we know we're going to get it back, we still have to go through the fiction of saying that the...
For Machiros Chomets... So that would not work. You are allowed to indicate to the non-Jew who will be buying your chametz that you intend to purchase it back after Pesach. But yeah, matan amanas lahachzer per se would not work for that.
Yeah. So the thing with you have to own it. Is the only thing you have to do is say I'm giving you this as a present. I would like you to give it me back when you're finished with it, or what? How do you say that?
Yeah, but if you say it in that formulation, then the person doesn't want to give it back to you, it doesn't have to.
So what do you do?
If you say, if you here's the lulav, I'm giving to you as a present on condition that you give it to me back.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You can't say I would like you to give it to me back afterwards.
Okay.
You could do that,
fine.
But that
so
doesn't help you very much.
Yeah. To say is I'm giving you this as a present on the condition that you give it to me back.
Right.
Get over, she, the woman does.
Right. No, all she has to say is, I'm giving it to you. You know, I'm transferring ownership.
Correct, but then you could walk off with it.
Right.
She could trust you to give it back afterwards. That's,
okay.
Perfectly reasonable.
The basic minimum, she said, here, I'm giving you
to
this.
Say it.
As a present.
And here, I'm
right.
giving you this as a
now,
present.
Wait a second, though. Why is the word having anything to do with the Kenyan, though? A Kenyan basically has to do with, you know, like, Mashiach or something like that. They're,
a word? What do you mean?
Saying the words.
You want to specify that at some... Well, first of all, if you just hand it to someone without saying anything, then it could be a lending.
You have to say, I'm giving this to you.
Right. You have to state that it is an absolute acquisition. Well, right, but unless she really had in mind that everybody else should acquire it as a matana manas achzer. If that's the assumption, you know, if there's a sign... So then the Sefer HaChinuch now discusses the din hashutfin. Somebody was talking before about what happens if somebody, two people, co-own a lulav. Shekanu esrog b'shutfa, so they created a partnership to buy an esrog. They can't each necessarily afford their own esrog, lulav and esrog. So let's say they want to buy a super mehudar esrog, and their set of arba minim is going to cost $300. So then what they want to do it together. They can't each afford $300, but they can afford $150. So they buy it together. So let's say they are brothers who just inherited their father's estate, and they haven't fully divided the assets yet. This is yours, this is yours, this is yours, this is yours. But from the lump sum of the estate, the brothers purchased a lulav. So if this is the case, so does that count as something that you could be yotzei the mitzvah with? Because it's technically, there is more than one person who has some sort of ownership over this object.
You just said husband and wife couldn't have a partnership with it. So how are these brothers having a partnership?
Oh, because the Sefer HaChinuch is going to explain. Excellent. She'im kanu al das lotzeis bo yotzim bo kol echad mehem. If everybody, if these people got together and said, yeah, we want to buy this lulav in order that we should both be yotzei with, and then the assumption is... each person can be yotzei with it. They don't need explicit giving of the part of the lulav that I own to you. The reason is that when you buy something specifically stating we're buying this in order to fulfill the mitzvah of lulav, so the assumption is that you bought it in order that each individual should be able to fulfill the mitzvah, meaning that when you have these partners who bought the lulav, so then when it comes time for the first partner to fulfill the mitzvah, when he picks up the lulav to fulfill the mitzvah, the assumption is that all the other partners at that point completely nullify their jurisdiction over this lulav, and they have intention to give this one individual their parts of the lulav as a present. And then when the next person acquires it, so that he acquires it completely, and the other people forgo their joint ownership of it. So if a husband and a wife bought, it would be the same thing. If a husband and a wife bought the lulav together, so then they would have to, and if they bought it specifically to be yotzei with it, so the assumption would be that, you know, if the husband goes to hashkama, then the wife wants to use it later in the day, that when she acquires the lulav later in the day, the assumption would be that the husband would give her absolute ownership of the lulav, and that she would in the morning in Parash Gavim and give her husband the ownership of the lulav.
Okay.
There is a halachic mechanism that has to be overcome, which is that kol ma shekonsa isha kona baila, that because that the husband is supposed to support the wife, so as a incentive to support the wife with all his ability, so anything that the wife acquires automatically goes to partial ownership. Ownership, really, of the husband. So this would have to be overcome. There are situations where the wife, let's say the wife has a business of her own in the marriage. So then she tells her husband, I am forgoing you supporting me. I'm going to pay for my own food. He still could give her food if he wants. But she says to him, I'm going to pay for my own food. I'm not taking any money from you, and I want my business to fully belong to me. So that's one way of doing it. Or if a woman, if you give a woman a lulav as a present, let's say to be yotzei on the first day of Sukkot, so then you need to specify explicitly that I'm giving you this present, and I, on the express condition, that your husband not acquire it. So in that type of situation, then even a woman who's being supported by her husband could have full property of her own. Yeah.
That they're supposed to be supporting their husbands in kol. They work. He sits and learns. So how is it he's supporting his wife? And not just in the general picture. That's another discussion.
Everybody agrees that it's the husband's obligation to support his wife. However, if that's the basic assumption and way that life works, but if the couple makes a decision to do the finances in a slightly different way, then that's fine.
Okay.
But everybody agrees that a woman at any point during her husband's stint in kollel should say, okay, had enough, I'm not working anymore, I want to stay home with the kids, get out of Kollel, and start working to support me. But if she says she wants...
Really, a Beis Din would support that? In a Haredi community?
Unless you made some sort of condition at the beginning of the marriage where, you know, Harayat Mikudeshes Li, on the condition that you always support. But that's not really right, because that's Mevatel from the beginning, a mitzvah deraisa, that the husband has to support the wife. I mean, such a thing does work, but... You know, the assumption, again, this, again, we're talking about forcible and bezdin, non-enforceable bezdin in certain situations. In most situations, especially in America, there's no assumption absolutely that under any circumstances the husband is not going to work. Usually, the mindset in America is, okay, you know, we'd really like to start out in Kollel. The wife says, I want my husband to learn Torah as much as possible. It's her right. If she feels that she's getting schar for that, you know, fine, more power to you, you can afford it, you're not going to go crazy, so great. But if she, the assumption normally is, starting off right on the bat of the marriage is, you know, we're going to do this as long as we can. And if at some point it becomes unsupportable, then, you know, we're going to have to rearrange, you're going to have to start either get a job either in chinuch or some Jewish thing, or you'll have to go to school. It's very unusual in America that you recognize already when the husband is at age, you know, 22, whenever he's getting married, that he already knows Shas backwards and forwards. He's going to become one of the Gedolei Hador, that he's for sure not going to spend a day of work in his life. That the wife is under an absolute impression that it has absolutely no chance that he will ever be working, and it's definitely going to fall under her to support him. In Israel, I say that's probably a little bit more common, just because it's more societally pushed. But yeah, that's even in Israel, you know, the halacha doesn't change if the wife doesn't want it, so the husband has to support her. Okay. V'dinei ha-na'nua, there's one thing that we do with the lulav that's called na'nuim, which is mentioned, you know, in the very earliest sources. And it's commented in the Gemara. It doesn't even say this explicitly in the Mishnah, that the Gemara comments that, why is it talking about na'nuim? Because once you pick up the lulav, you're yotzei the mitzvah. So it doesn't really say that in the Mishnayos. The Mishnayos, it says that once a young child knows how to do the na'nuim, how to shake the lulav, then you buy him a lulav because of chinuch. So the Mishnah seems to assume that, again, that what you're doing with the lulav is shaking it. But the Gemara says, no, but the technical minimal requirement for being yotzei the mitzvah of the four species is simply to pick it up. You don't have to shake the lulav in order to be yotzei the mitzvah, but the na'nuim are considered the most correct manifestation of the mitzvah of lulav, which is shaking it.
I was under the impression, some early point, whereas that, you know, you're really supposed to shake it so the, you know, lulav rattles a little bit or something like that, makes some noise. But I notice now everybody sort of just very quietly just pushes it up and down. Is that just simply...
So the truth is that there's a major disagreement about what exactly constitutes the na'nuim. So let's do the next sentence, then we'll go into that. Sheachiyuv, what's the obligation? Leholich ulahavi ulahalos ulahorid. That just like the menachos in the Beis HaMikdash, when you're doing the karbonos in the Beis HaMikdash, when you're waving them, the way you do it is forth, back, up, down. So that's what the Rambam says. That's how you do the na'nuim also.
No.
No. The Rambam says that the way you do the lulav is you go forth, back, up, down. That's all. Very simple things. And the Rambam says that you're supposed to shake the leaves while you're doing this. The way he says to do it is you go out, you give three little shakes. You come in, give three little shakes. You go up, three little shakes. Go down, three little shakes. So we have the custom, which is based on many other Rishonim, which is that we shake the lulav in all the directions. They're not just forward, back, up, down. You go... If you don't have a lulav in your hand, you don't even remember what you're doing.
The order is also important.
The order is important. That the Mechaber says in Shulchan Aruch, which is not argued with by anyone in the Shulchan Aruch, this was the old custom of both Ashkenazim and Sfardim, which is the way you do it is you go around to the right. That we know in Halacha, when you make turns, you know, we always favor the right side, so you're supposed to turn to the right. So you go this like this, first like this, then like this, you know, front, right, actually goes by the directions of the... You're supposed to stand facing the east, so it goes east, north, east, south, west, north, up, down. That's how you do it. And Alpi Kabbalah, the Arizal said that you do it in a different order. So you do right, left, front, back, up, down, which is the minhag of Hasidim, because they follow the Arizal, and also the current minhag of Sfardim, although, like I said, in the Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber in the Shulchan Aruch says to do it the regular way. So I pointed out when we were talking about this a few sukkahs ago, that when you're in davening in a shul, you're supposed to do the nanuim in accordance with the custom of the shul and not with your own personal custom. It doesn't look right for you. Somebody's looking out at the shul that people are doing. Some people are going like this. Some people are going like this. It's it looks like hefkerdik. It's not proper to do differently publicly. I mean, again, silent davening, you know, everybody can say their own nusach. But the stuff that's recognizable to the congregation has to be the same, similar to what we're talking about, tefillin on Chol HaMoed. Not exactly the same, but the... So that's why it's interesting that you tell... Sfardim don't like to change their customs, even when they're in an Ashkenazi shul a lot of times. So they do the Arizal way, but it's kind of humorous, because in Shulchan Aruch, the Mechaber, as Sfardi as it can get, says to do the way that Ashkenazim still do. So they shouldn't think they're being un-Sfardi by... Even if it would constitute being un-Sfardi, they should still do it if they're diving in Ashkenazi shul. But it's still fully...
Sfardi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Spanish Middle Eastern Jews, not Chassidim. Although this would apply to Chassidim also. Some Rishonim say that also you should davke not do the Rambam's way of just forward, back, up, and down, because it looks like a cross. But it doesn't really matter. Nobody thinks.
Yeah, I guess
from the side.
Yeah. Nobody really does that anymore, so it doesn't really matter. But there is a disagreement about the shaking of the leaves. That again, it seems to be that in most Rishonim, the shaking, you move the lulav and then you give it a little shake. Then when you bring it back, you give a little shake and with all the other directions. So the Ramah, in his commentary in the Shulchan Aruch, brings that the Ashkenazi minag was not to do little shakes at the end of the stroke, so to speak, but rather to shake it, to do three movements, and to shake it during the moving of the lulav. So that's the difference would be, you know, in according to some shittas, you go three little shakes, 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 three little shakes. And then, but the Ramah's minhag is shake, 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 shake. By the way, when I go shake, shake, shake towards the back, there is a common misconception that you have to look in the direction that you wave the lulav.
That's to make sure you don't put somebody's eye out.
Okay, you can go like that, make sure there's no one right behind you. But you see sometimes, I think I'll be the Arizal. You are supposed to do this, so the Sfardim actually, you know, move in different directions when they shake the lulav, but that's not really the way it says in the Rishonim, and that our minag is, if you see Ashkenazi doing this, so it's not really right. When you do the waving to the back, it's perfectly acceptable to just go over your shoulder. You don't have to actually turn around and face the back in order to shake the lulav towards the back.
It's not going to poke somebody.
Fine. So that's the two approaches of many Rishonim and of the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, which is the Ashkenazi minhag again, that we actually go back and forth three times whilst shaking the lulav. However, the Arizal said something very odd, which again is something that Sfardim do that's different from Ashkenazim, which is against basically what all Rishonim say. Not I can say all, but what most of Rishonim say, that the Nanuim do involve rustling the leaves of the lulav. The Arizal said that no, you just have to gently go three times in each direction, and you don't need to rustle, or maybe you said you shouldn't, I don't remember the exact formulation, rustle the leaves at all. So that's why you see some Chassidim and Sfardim, that they just gently move the lulav back and forth three times, and they do not rustle the leaves at all. But again, if you're Ashkenazi, it could be, argument could be made for other people as well, but Ashkenazim certainly have not adopted that minhag, that you really should rustle the leaves. Again, you shouldn't break the lulav. You don't need to do that. Just, gentle, give it a nice, gentle little rustle. So we have all these dinim about how exactly to do the nanuim. Again, I told you I spoke on Sukkot a couple years ago about all of the different shittas about how to do the nanuim. And the last source that I brought in my source sheet was the Magid Mishnah in his commentary on the Rambam in the Hilchos Lulav when he discusses the nanuim, where he gives, a short summary of the different opinions about the nanuim, and then he concludes with, but you shouldn't spend too much time discussing this, because anyway you shake it, you're Yotze anyway, so you don't have to worry too much about the exact method that you shake it, because first of all, like I said, the nanuim, you're Yotze the mitzvah of Lulav just by picking it up. But again, as long as you shake it around somehow, so you'll be Yotze B'dyeved, the mitzvah of the Nanuim, it's very difficult not to be Yotze B'dyeved, the mitzvah of Nanuim, which again, in and of themselves, are really just the most correct manifestation of the mitzvah of Lulav, and not essential for fulfilling the mitzvah of Lulav. But that's not to say that you shouldn't know how to do it correctly. If you daven in an Ashkenazi shul, you should know how to do it. If you're going in a weird direction, or you're making the little rustlings at the end, so you're going to stand out. So the minhag is, you wave three times and you rustle during the waving. Yeah.
Some people, when they come to shul, they immediately, take their lulav and they go off into the sukkah to take the lulav and the bracha in the sukkah, and then they come in and they don't say the bracha, obviously, when they're during challah.
There's al pi kabbalah, there's a mitzvah min amuvchar. A most preferable way to fulfill the mitzvah of lulav is to do it in connection with the other mitzvah of the holiday, which is the mitzvah of sukkah. So to shake lulav and esrog, when you first get up in the morning, you don't want to wait, and you should fulfill the mitzvah of lulav and esrog within the sukkah. So others say you're not supposed to do that because the main mitzvah of lulav is during halal. Again, you're yotze the mitzvah of lulav anytime you pick it up during the day. But the most correct place to do the shaking and to do the taking of the lulav is during the recitation of the halal, during Hodu Hashem Ki Tov Ki Olam Chasdo, and during Ana Hashem Hoshiyana. And Ashkenazim also have the minhag of shaking it during Yom Arna Yisrael. The Chazan says Yom Arna Yisrael. And in Boris, they do it at all four. Some people also shake the lulav a little bit during the Hoshanos. You say Hoshana Lemancha Hashem Elokeinu Hoshana, that you're supposed to shake a little bit then, because it's reminiscent of the Halal, as well as the same themes are discussed there. So some people say that it's more correct to make the bracha on the lulav immediately before the Halal, because that it makes the bracha go on the shaking of the lulav during the Halal, which is the main shaking of the lulav. So that's why the differences of approach regarding this, whether you want to be makbid on the Kabbalistic idea to take the lulav and esrog in the sukkah, or you want to say the bracha right before the halal. Of course, there is a way to be yotze both, which is that right after chazaras hashatz, you run to the sukkah, you make the bracha on the lulav and esrog in the sukkah, then you run back into shul, and there's not going to be enough time. They might have started halal without you already. So that you shouldn't do, but yeah, there was actually, we had this past year where we had on the first day of Sukkot a minyan mitzumtzum, 10 men literally, that someone was about to go to the sukkah to shake the lulav. Everybody started yelling at him, stop, come back, you can't. So very correctly, he just didn't realize that he was number 10 for the minyan. So he came back in right away and he forewent his normal practice that he considered to be preferable of shaking the lulav and esrog in the sukkah, and just made the bracha on the lulav and esrog in the shul, so as not to delay the congregation in the recitation of halal. So not everybody would be so wise. Some people would say, no, my minhag is to shake the lulav and esrog in the sukkah. So that trumps all of you. That's not really right. Our minhag also is, although it's not mentioned in Chazal explicitly, is to shake the lulav right after the bracha, which is a discussion in the Rishonim, but according to some opinions, you just make the bracha, not shake it, and just shake it when you get there in the halal, but our minhag is to shake it right after the bracha as well. I forgot to mention that when it says you're supposed to be morid the lulav, that when you shake the lulav downwards, so when most people shake the lulav downwards, you know, they're sort of trying to go like this to try to go down.
Right, right.
Because we're trying to be makbid that when you always have to have the lulav in the correct direction. Mm-hmm. It's always supposed to be going up, like in the same direction it would be on the tree. Like the hadassim grow with a root down, and the aravos too with a root root. Oh, sorry.
Wait, the esrog presumably points down though, right?
Okay. Yeah. So we try to keep it in that same direction. So you're going like this, but according to some opinions, you actually should when you go downwards, you're actually supposed to flip it over and go like that. But our normal minhag nowadays is that we just sort of go downwards, even though it's not really clear that you're going down if you can't really bend down that far.
In any case,
your yotze anyway. Your yotze anyway. Some people after davening they shake the lulav again and they point downwards. Oh, we mentioned the bracha. So when do you make the bracha on the when do you make the bracha on the lulav and esrog?
Just before you shake it.
Just before you shake it. So you have a problem. The Gemara says
before you actually take it properly.
Oh, so you have a problem. The Gemara says that we have a principle that you're supposed to make the bracha immediately in advance of doing a mitzvah. So you have a problem with the lulav and esrog because if the lulav and esrog are on the table and you haven't picked them up yet. Then you make the bracha on Dilas Lulav, then you still have to pick up this, you know, you have to bring them together. The Gemara seems to assume, although I'm not sure exactly why, the Gemara seems to assume that that's too much of an interruption between the bracha and the performance of the mitzvah. And if you pick it up already and you make the bracha, so then you're yotze the mitzvah already and you can't make the bracha anymore because you already, it's not really proper to make the bracha because you already fulfilled the mitzvah and the bracha won't be right before the taking of the lulav and esrog. So the Gemara says you have no choice. That it's better to pick up the lulav and esrog before, and then make the bracha, and then shake away with continue to recite the halal. So as Rav Shechter likes to say, nowadays we've outsmarted the Gemara. That nowadays we have this idea that you turn the esrog upside down, so therefore it's in the wrong direction. And then you make the bracha, and then you flip it over. So that's considered a very minor interruption between the bracha and the performance of the mitzvah. So that's the minhag of most people nowadays. The Vilna Gaon and others held that no, you should do like the Gemara. You should just have kavana. You should have in mind that you don't want to fulfill the mitzvah till after the bracha. So you hold the lulav and esrog, and you think, I'm not fulfilling the mitzvah. I'm just holding a bunch of plants right now. I'm not doing the mitzvah lulav and esrog. Then you make the bracha, and you say, oh, now I fulfill the mitzvah. So. Yeah, so at the end, there are different
I think even without consciously thinking of it that way, most people, the feeling is, I took it, right side up, but I'm not finished until I say the bracha.
Okay, so good. That's good. But again, the normal minhag is that you turn the esrog upside down and then right side up right after the bracha. So why do we shake the lulav? So everything all around is from God. So we shake the lulav in all the directions. The Gemara, also, Gemara and then the Rishonim also mention about how it's like some sort of mystical thing about the winds and the rains and the dews that you want to get rid of them from all the directions. So you sort of whack them with the lulav in all the different directions the bad rains and the bad winds. So you want to get rid of them in all four directions. That's why you shake the lulav in all four directions. It's sort of like a sword. So, yeah. And also one Amora mentioned in the Gemara that when he shook the lulav like this, he used to say that he was poking Satan in the eye. So then somebody told him he shouldn't do that because it's going to make Satan angry and, you know, the Satan is going to do bad things. Okay, again, exactly what this means I can't tell you, but that's the story. But yeah, you should make sure. That's what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter famously said, that people don't pay enough attention to other people around them. Pay too much attention to the Bein Adam Lamakom mitzvahs that he says you see all the time in shuls and people put on their talis. So he's doing mitzvahs like Sata Betzitzis, you know, with great gusto, you know, they wrap the talis around themselves and you slap someone else in the face with a tzitzis. So he says if you do that, then that's a major problem with your religious priorities. Shakol Nichlal Bezeh. Fine. So all these, you shake the lulav in all the directions. So the Sefer HaChinuch's more rationalistic understanding is that it's supposed to draw your attention to the fact that everything around you in the world comes from God, and great, make your simcha relevant to everything all around you. All the details are explained in Maseches Sukkah. In all places and all times, b'zecharim v'lo b'nekevos, just like all positive time-bound commandments, almost all, it applies to males and not to females. But of course, if a female wishes to fulfill the mitzvah voluntarily, then she is more than welcome to do so. And this is the general custom nowadays, that women are very makbid to fulfill the mitzvah of the four species.
Now wait, the Sfardim holds it with the woman, she can do it, but she shouldn't say the bracha, or is that...
Correct. Right. So there is a major machlokas rishonim, whether if a woman volunteers to perform a mitzvah sasei shazman grama, whether she's allowed to make the bracha or not. That we paskin that Ashkenazi minag is that she is allowed to make the bracha, because when it says, asher kitchanu mitzvosa v'tzivanu, when sanctified with our... God sanctified us with his commandments and commanded us regarding taking of the lulav, for example, so then it doesn't mean, it means us, it means the Jewish people, and you're allowed to volunteer such a bracha. But Sfardim, as we know, are more stringent about a bracha she'ina tzricha, and possibly not required bracha, because the Sfardim hold that it's literally a violation of lo sisa, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, whereas Ashkenazi poskim generally hold that it doesn't mean it's a good thing to do, but it's not, you know, the Gemara says that it's relevant to Lo Sisa, but it's not literally a deraisa violation of Lo Sisa. So therefore, Ashkenazim are a little bit more relaxed in general about bracha she'ina tzricha, when the normative psak is to make the bracha. But Sfardim say, no, a woman can't say, yesher kitchanu mitzvosa v'tzivanu, us meaning, you know, talking about us in general, but it's that this person was not commanded to take the lulav, so you can't make that bracha.
So
that's the basic idea.
For the Sfar, then ditto say ketanim. Like some can't be for the
bracha. No, ketanim is for chinuch. That's different.
Oh.
A woman, an adult woman, doesn't need chinuch. She's supposed to know the mitzvahs already.
Still, you know,
No, the Gemara says explicitly that children are allowed to make brachas even when they're not necessary, okay, because of chinuch purposes. Okay. So the over aleha the low, it's also should make sure that a woman has to make sure that if she's fulfilling the mitzvah that her lulav and esrog are kosher. Some a woman might think, you know, especially if she's making a bracha, you know, that goes without saying that she has to make sure the lulav and esrog are kosher. But some women go shopping and they say, I'm just a woman, you know, I'm not really chayiv in this, so you know, I'll just take whatever you have. But it's not that's not the right attitude. If you're going to do it, you should do it properly. Doesn't mean you have to get the most expensive set. So if you neglected to take the lulav and esrog, and again on the first day outside of the Beis Hamikdash and all 7 days in the Beis Hamikdash, and you neglected to perform this positive commandment, and the Sefer HaChinuch mentions again, this is not part of the Doraisa mitzvah. But the Sefer HaChinuch alludes to the fact that we do not take the lulav on Shabbos. Why? Even if it's the first day, at least outside of the Beis HaMikdash, that even if it's the first day, okay, you could understand, okay, nowadays that there's no Beis HaMikdash, so the lulav is only the rice on the first day, and the rest of the 6 days are the Rabbanan. So if the one of the 6 days falls on Shabbos, and Chazal said, they said to take the lulav, and they said not to take the lulav, but Chazal even said that if the first day is Shabbos, you're not to take the lulav. That's because that with many cases in halacha regarding Purim, again in our calendar, Purim, Shushan Purim does sometimes fall on Shabbos, but regular Purim doesn't fall on Shabbos ever. But in the times where they actually sanctify the new months based on the sighting of the moon, and Purim could fall on any day of the week, then they're not to read the Megillah on Shabbos. You're not to blow the shofar on Shabbos. You're not to take the lulav on Shabbos. This is all because of a concern that you might carry it outside 4 cubits in Rishus HaRabim in the public domain. Yeah.
If you're in business selling lulavim.
Yeah.
And then you think, you still have some left over. You're still in business, so I say, mm-hmm. Sukkos, which most of them aren't at that point, right?
Yeah.
Then could you just sort of grab one you had intended to sell and be yotzei the mitzvah with that, because you didn't have, your intention was not for it to, you own it, but your intention was to get it sell.
Yeah, but lemaisa you own it.
But okay. You do own okay. It.
Lemaisa you own it. As long as it belongs to you, it doesn't matter what you want to do. Let's say you're a lulav collector. You think they're pretty. You decorate your house with lulavim all year round. So, let's say your main lulav breaks, and you want to take one from your collection to use on Sukkos.
Probably
what are you supposed to do with them after Sukkos?
What are you supposed to do with the lulav after Sukkos? So the
put it on top of the aron so the janitor throws them out after a while.
Yeah. Right. So one thing you should not do, in my opinion, is put it on top of the aron, which just creates a problem. There are some Kabbalistic sources that somehow suggest this, but lemaisa, I do not think you should put it on top of the aron because it just creates a mess for other people to clean up, and it creates clutter in the shul. So, and it's not so attractive to the Beis HaMikdash, right? I mean, not the Beis HaMikdash, the Beis HaKnesses, the shul. So you should not do that, even though some people do that. Some people do the Hoshanos. Some people also throw the willows for Hoshana Rabbah on top of the Aron. But Lemaisa, the best thing to do with them is to save them for use in another mitzvah. What's another mitzvah?
The feather.
Right. So some people save the lulav they let it dry out over the course of 6 months, and then they either use it to stoke the fire for baking matzahs or for burning the chametz. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So that's the best thing to do with it.
The
esrig? The esrig some people use for Havdalah.
They stick cloves in it.
Yeah, you stick cloves in it. And
are you allowed to just throw it out?
Respectfully, yes.
You wrap it up.
You wrap it up and throw it out. You can't just throw it in the garbage with all the waste, food waste and coffee diapers grinds. And coffee. Yeah, you can't. I'll do that. But if you wrap it up and you... and you dispose of it in a respectful manner, then that would be acceptable. Let's say you're like, I can't handle putting this somewhere for 6 months, and I'm going to lose track of it. And so then you should just throw it out respectfully. Oh, the esrig, yeah, of course. The best thing to do with the esrig is to eat it.
Wait, I thought that they spray them with pesticides.
They do load them up with pesticides, that's true. So it is a bit of sakana stefashis, but maybe if you peel it, if you take off the peel, you don't use the zest.
No, you make esrig liqueur out of the peel. Hmm.
Not
with the pesticides.
Perhaps you could get there. They have special washes that claim to remove pesticides, but maybe I don't know if it really does the trick. Because they don't think when the farmers are growing these esrogim, they're not thinking that people are going to eat them. They just want the most beautiful product possible. They'll get them the most money when they can sell them before Sukkos. So get an organic esrog.
Oh,
okay.
So
there we go.
There's no such thing really, but I'm sure in Italy there is such a thing. But kosher.
And you can plant the seeds and you get really cute little esrogim.
Right. So if you plant the seeds and you grow your own esrogim, so then don't use pesticides.
You can eat the
esrog. Uva mikdash in the base of mikdash, hayanital biyom rishon afilu b'shabbes, but. Not only in the Beis HaMikdash, it's a question why the Sefer Chinuch formulates it this way, but it was not only in the Beis HaMikdash, but in the time where they were Mekadesh al Pi HaRe'iyah, when they sanctified the new month based on the sighting of the new moon, then they used to take the Lulav on Shabbos in a place that was close enough to Yerushalayim that they knew for sure which day was the actual first day of Sukkos. But nowadays, we have a general prohibition to take the Lulav on Shabbos lest we carry it 4 cubits in the public domain. Okay, even if there you happen to live in a community with an Eruv, nevertheless, Chazal forbade taking the lulav in all places. So they were so concerned that someone might violate carrying the lulav outside on Shabbos in a place they're not allowed to carry, then they established this rule. That's why some people have a question on the idea, you know, people throw around the rule, the statement that's found in some Rishonim, that Ein Lanu Rishus Harabim Daraisa Bizman Hazeh. That nowadays, there's basically no such thing anymore as a Rishus Harabim Daraisa, that an actual place where it's biblically forbidden to carry on Shabbos. And everything, all of our streets basically have the din of Carmelis, which is only the Rabbanan you're not allowed to carry there, but Mi Daraisa you are allowed to carry there. That's why in such a place, in a Carmelis, so that's where the door frames, what we call colloquially call an Eruv, works, but in a real Rishus Harabim Daraisa, the door frames do not work. You would need actual doors to block off the streets. So, but that idea, again, some people answer this question, but some people bring this idea that Chazal declared forevermore that you're not allowed to carry the lulav on Shabbos, that if Rishus Harabim Daraisa was such a rare occurrence and that there would be times in the future where it would hardly ever be found, then why did they go so far as to nullify the mitzvah of shofar and the sukkah and the shofar and lulav even when it's they canceled out the Daraisa because of this concern. Yeah.
Well, they didn't want us going around carrying a lulav through a Carmelis either. You know, I mean, it's a,
no, but they wouldn't have made such a gzera if there was only an issue of a Carmelis.
Well, maybe not.
Yeah.
That's still an issue.
What do you mean?
About Richard Sir Robin. You hear in a lot of discussions about can you have an Arab in this neighborhood or that neighborhood or wherever. Is Broadway Richard Sir Robin? Is it not?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. You hear that a lot.
Right. So according to many poskim, there are situations nowadays of Richard Sir Robin Daraisa. According to many poskim, Rishus HaRabim got resurrected in our days. What does that mean? So according to those poskim, so we know there's a major machlokis among the Rishonim as to whether in order for something to constitute a Rishus HaRabim Daraisa, it needs to service a population of 600,000 people or not. Some Rishonim hold that any street that's 16 amos wide, about 30 feet wide, any street that's 30 feet wide is a Rishus HaRabim Daraisa, the Rambam. Seems to hold something similar like that. The Rashba, other Rishonim, seem to hold like that. But the accepted Psak, even though it's a somewhat more difficult Chita, is that in order for something to be a Rishus HaRabim Daraisa, it needs to service a population of 600,000 people. So that's why some people say that in the times of Chazal, you know, people, the whole Jewish people used to come to Yerushalayim, so then it was a Rishus HaRabim Daraisa. City like Rome. It was a huge, huge city. There were hundreds of thousands of people. The streets in Rome were Rishus HaRabim Daraisa. But then in the Middle Ages, you know, they didn't have such good infrastructure. So in the Middle Ages, when all these Rishonim were writing, and they would say, you know, nowadays we don't have Rishus HaRabim Daraisa, they meant because there were no cities and towns that serviced a population of 600,000 people. That's why a lot of poskim say that even though that when the Rishonim say there's no Rishus HaRabim Daraisa anymore, they didn't mean forevermore there's no more Rishus HaRabim Daraisa. They meant in those times, in the Middle Ages, there was no Rishus HaRabim Daraisa. But the Aruch HaShulchan says like this. I mean, many poskim say like this. That nowadays, where extremely large cities are the norm, and there are many cities that service a population of 600,000 people, so the din of Rishus HaRabim Daraisa, even according to those shitas that require 600,000 people, has been resurrected. So now we do have to be concerned with Rishus HaRabim Daraisa, which the din of the Middle Ages.
600,000 people or 600,000 Jews?
People.
People.
Yeah.
In what time period?
What do you mean?
I mean, 600,000.
Some people have this notion that the shita that holds that 600,000 people is required for Rishus HaRabim mean that 600,000 people have to traverse that street on a daily basis, which is absurd. There's no street. There certainly was no street in Yerushalayim and Rome and all these places in the olden days. Certainly, and even nowadays, there's no street that services a population that literally 600,000 people traverse that street on a daily basis. It means.
Is it possible that that many people go up and down Broadway?
No.
For the George Washington Bridge?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Really? 24
George
hours
Washington
a day?
Bridge?
Wow. I don't think so. But anyway, it's pretty clear that when the shita is the hold, you need 600,000 people in order for something to be considered Shus Rav and Daraisa. What it really means is that it services a population of 600,000 people, meaning the surrounding area that uses that street contains a population of 600,000 people or more.
Why is it 600,000 people? There were like 600,000 men in the desert.
That's correct. However, the poskim say that since that's the explicit figure that was given, and no other explicit figure that was given in the desert, so that's the figure that we have to use. Although Reb Moshe Feinstein says a sort of svara like you say, which is that the 600,000 people, you're right, you go intrinsically you go based on the whole population in the desert, which according to the calculations are something like 3 million. Yeah. It means that these shitas hold that 600,000 people have to be present in order to be considered Rishus HaRabim Daraisa, it means, according to Reb Moshe Feinstein, that 600,000 people have to be out and about on the streets of the city at that time, which means that the city has to contain a population of 3 million people, which is the total figure of the desert. So that's a huge chiddush, that's not found in any of the earlier poskim, but that is why Reb Moshe Feinstein said that the only places in the world where you have to be choshesh for Rishus HaRabim Daraisa nowadays are Manhattan, 3 million people. We're close to 3 million people when people come in to work. And Brooklyn, he held. Again, people argue with his statistics and everything, but the whole thing is a chiddush. That's why he said that in most places nowadays, even in large cities, you can have an Eruv because because there's not a population of 3 million people with 600,000 people out on the streets. Okay. It's a big chiddush. Not everybody agrees with all his cheshbonus about why he's machmer in Manhattan, Brooklyn. I think it comes out in London, but also according to Rav Shavayin. Those are the three places where we have the most strife about Erevin. You know, everybody else.
Brooklyn, London, and
Brooklyn, Manhattan, and London.
Oh, okay.
Even though in most other places, most other cities, even large cities, again, there are many people who don't use the Erev because there is even according to Shita that 600,000. You know, it's very likely that other cities would, especially nowadays, would qualify. And again, you also have the shita that 600,000 is not required. So any street, any relatively wide street would be considered a rishus rabbim. But again, in most other places, quietly, either people use the Erev or they don't use the Erev. Nobody makes a big fuss about it. But in these three places, you have these wars about the Erev, where you have stereotypically, it's the more yeshivish Haredi population in these places that just, no, we can't have it, it's bad, you can't, no, Chilul Shabbos, whatever. And Chassidim and centrist Orthodox, modern Orthodox people, one time where they'll get along, generally are more liberal about Erevin, so they say that they're for the Erev even in very large places such as Manhattan, Brooklyn, and London. But again, most other cities in the world is not such an issue.
Los Angeles, they actually use the freeways, which are much better mechitzas, right?
Oh, my God.
Maybe.
No?
Yeah.
It's like football, the moral equivalent of war, you know.
Right, so again, we can go through a psychological, sociological analysis of why this issue in particular causes so much strife, where there's many other halachic issues where some rabbis say yes, some rabbis say no, and everybody manages to deal with each other.
There's a deep anxiety about doing the right thing. So.
Yeah, okay. Fine. But according to the Shita, that that any street that's 60 amos wide is a Rishus HaRabim, then it's really pretty easy to understand why Chazal would have made this Gzeira. Let's just start the next mitzvah since I said that I would. So
I
we'll.
Have to
okay.
Because I have to reach this. Thank goodness for the tape.
Yeah. Okay, so the next mitzvah Shin Chaf Hei, is mitzvah Yeshiva Sukkah, the mitzvah to dwell in the sukkah, our favorite mitzvah as Manhattan dwellers, right? Mitzvah Yeshiva Sukkah. Mitzvah Sukkah, Shenitztavinu Lasheves Basukkah, Shivas Yomim, that we were commanded to dwell in the sukkah for 7 days. Shenemar, Basukkah's Tesu Shivas Yomim, you should dwell in the sukkah for 7 days. V'yom Rishon U'b'yom Tesvav B'Tishrei. That's again, starting in the whole day we know is the first day of Sukkot. You have to dwell in the sukkah for 7 days. Mishor shi mitzvah. The reasoning is as follows: Mashem afurish b'kosuv leman nizkor anisim hagedolim she'asa hakel baruchu lavoseinu amidbar betseisa mimitzrayim. That we should remember the great miracles that God did for us in the desert. Shesikacham banane kavod shlo yaziklohem hashemesh bayom vekerach balayla. That God surrounded us with clouds of glory that protected us against the elements. Some explain that the sukkahs are literal booths, that they didn't build tents or houses in the desert, but they made these sort of temporary booths, and it's reminiscent of that. So this is already a disagreement among the earliest sages as to what the sukkahs represent. So we can go like both. We can have in mind both.
But didn't Bilam speak about the tents?
Yeah, but tents, it doesn't literally mean what we think of as a tent. When we come into a shul, we say Matovu Alecha Yaakov, that the shul is considered the tents of the Jewish people. But not literally what we call nowadays a tent. So when we remember all the good that God did for us in the desert, we will be more devoted to God's service. This is God's desire that he wants to do good for us, but he can only do good for us if we prepare ourselves by doing the mitzvos. And so this is actually one case, the mitzvah of sukkah is one case where the shor shi'a mitzvah is extremely important. I mean, it's always important to know, but according to the Bach asked the question, why does the Torah tell us specifically, L'man yedu doroseichem ki basukos v'shafti es b'nei Yisrael? God usually doesn't explain himself, the reasoning behind the mitzvah. But in this case, behind the mitzvah of sukkah, God says explicitly, so that you should remember that I caused the Jewish people to dwell in sukkos, in booths, when they were in the desert. So the Bach says that he thinks that maybe the reason that the Torah states the reason explicitly is that you're not yotzei the mitzvah of sukkah unless you remember the sukkos in the midbar during the time you fulfill the mitzvah. Unless you actually have the kavanah, not just to fill the mitzvah, but to remember the sukkos in the desert at the time that you fulfill the mitzvah. So again, not everybody agrees with the Bach by any means, but we try, especially the first night when the mitzvah of dwelling in sukkah is the most stringent, that we try when we're chewing our challah the first night of sukkah. So we try to have in mind, specifically like the Bach, to remember the actual sukkahs, either the Anani HaKavod or the real sukkahs, the booths in which our ancestors dwelled in the Midbar.
What are booths? What kind of booths?
Like a sukkah. Sukkah. Tabernacle, sukkah. The Feast of Tabernacles, right? Chag HaSukkos.